Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking with you today about pets. Aren't they a wonderful part of life? They cheer you up. You stay by your side, give you that warm, unconditional love. Life wouldn't be the same without them. And we're lucky to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine with us. She takes time every month to spend an hour and a half with us to give us some advice on keeping our pets happy and healthy. And Sandy, great to have you back.
It's nice to be back.
We have, April is what? Heartworm Awareness Month. That's what it is.
That's correct. And, you know, I just had, for the first time in a while, a heartworm positive dog come in. And this was the owner is so upset because she just didn't give heartworm preventative for the last year. And she just didn't think it was necessary. And here's a local dog that has never traveled out of Dane County that has contracted this disease that's so easy to prevent, but very costly, not only for the pet's health, but also for the owner's pocketbook to treat. So one of those things where we really need to get the word out that dogs and cats can get heartworm disease. I was looking up statistics, and so far in 2003, for Dane County, about one in 504 dogs is heartworm positive, which doesn't sound like that many, but it's probably going to be growing because we don't even have mosquito populations out yet, and that is the bug that spreads heartworm. So if your dog isn't on heartworm preventative, they should be on it. Remember, the way the pill works is it works backwards. The day you give it, it eliminates what they've been exposed to for the prior month. So if you're thinking of taking your dog to a warmer climate to get away from our cool spring weather, your dog should be, getting on heartworm preventative probably while you're down there rather than before you leave, because it's kind of odd the way this stuff works. But most people end up ending it too early in the season. I've had several clients in recently that rather than using it year-round, which is what's recommended nationally by the American Heartworm Society, they stopped giving it in October. So that October pill protected for September, and there were still mosquitoes around in October.
Well,
so now
we're
waiting to find out whether they're going to check positive or not. So, So anyways, get your dogs on heartworm preventative.
And, you know, sometimes people look at raccoons and they say, oh, they're kind of cute in the backyard and so forth, but there are problems there.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. You know, because what they carry is a parasite that is a problem for them, or not for them so much, but for us. That's a roundworm called Bacillus acarus. And they pass it in the stool, and they estimate that about 92% of raccoons carry this particular parasite. And so where they go to the restroom, their kind of raccoon latrines, they call them, can be a real hot zone for this particular parasite. And I know a lot of people that have dogs that like to roll in things, and that happens to be one of the popular things for dogs to roll in. The recommendation is if your dog has rolled in some unidentified droppings, and it potentially could be raccoon droppings, bathe them outside, probably wear clothes to cover up your clothes so you're not bringing things back in if you're having to hold the dog. And just be really, really careful with good hygiene. But get that dog bathed and try to keep them away from areas where raccoons may be living and having a good time.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Well, Julie in Sparta has a question for you, Dr. Sandy. Let's go to her. Hi, Julie.
Hi. I just was hoping that the doctor would reiterate on the poison plants now that Easter has passed and a lot of us have Easter lilies in the home. On Friday, my one-year-old cat became lethargic and immobile, and I had to put her to sleep today because she... People that don't understand about some plants, Easter lilies in particular, it's toxic. There's no recovering once they eat it, and they die within 3 to 5 days.
Yeah.
Which was a real shame because, you know, I did put it up. I was aware of it, but it wasn't enough.
Yeah.
Cats are curious.
They sure are. And I am so sorry for your loss. Any of the Asiatic lilies are very toxic for cats, and they just have to chew on a leaf. They don't have to eat that much of it, but just tasting it, chewing on it. And this would even be some of the lily plants that can be planted outdoors as well, not just the Easter lily. So you really have to know what plants you can safely have around. And I have been wanting forever, since we knew that this was a problem for cats, to have warning labels or something put on these plants so that people, when they're wanting to buy one, see, oh, don't use it in a household with cats. Well, maybe, you know, prevent some issues like what you've experienced this week. And there are some great resources for people to go to. The Poison Control Center has a wonderful website that is called the Pet Poison Helpline, all one word, okay, .com. And on that you can go to toxic plants, and they have listed there. You can also find this on the ASPCA's website. They have a link for all the toxic plants as well. And the reason why I found out about this is there was a clinic out in Colorado that just recently had several employees there get very, very ill because a dog came in that had eaten one of the more common, getting to be more common, rat poisons that are a zinc phosphate rat poison. And what happens is when a dog eats this, the acid in the stomach turns it into phosphide gas, and or phosphine gas, I should say, which is very toxic. The dog ended up dying, but before it died, it vomited, and all the people that were around the dog ended up having to go into the emergency room for respiratory distress from inhaling this gas. So, you know, something like that, who would think, you know, because most of the time when we're dealing with toxins, we want to try to make the pet vomit. But in this case, it would be a problem if you did. You'd want to do it outdoors. And this is where, if your pet eats something, contact your veterinarian. You could also, you know, go to this website, or you can directly contact the Poison Control Center. There is a fee. I think it's like $39 for a consultation, but they do such a great job of not only helping you through the episode, working with your veterinarian, but also doing follow-up with you as well. So, you know, having that phone number handy and following their directions for a list of things to have in your home for poison treatment if necessary, because sometimes it's something that needs to be taken care of right away. And they have a nice little poison kit that you can put together. So,
Julie, sorry for your loss, but thanks for calling.
Yeah, and thank you for talking about it.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. The number to call, by the way, 1-800-642-1234 if you want to join in. And we posted already that poison control site. We'll get it posted up on the website if we don't have it. I'm pretty sure we do have it up there. Let's go to Prudy in Greenfield next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Wonderful program. Now, my question is is this up on heartworm medication, and the chances for a dog or cat getting heartworm, especially cats? We've owned many dogs over the years and have taken them in for everything, heartworm, all of that. Mm-hmm. But now that we have two cats that are only indoors, is it safe to assume that heartworm medication is unnecessary?
Well, cats do get heartworm. They get it at less than 20% the rate that dogs get it. And an indoor cat living in Wisconsin, it's going to be pretty low odds of them getting exposed to it. But if I was living with a cat in a warmer climate down in the south where heartworm is there, it's just endemic everywhere, I would even have a heartworm or a cat that's indoors on heartworm preventative. And there are some nice, easy-to-use heartworm preventatives in cats that are spot-on products. So it's not like a dog where you may be thinking, I have to give a big pill to them once a month. There are products that make it easy. But I think for your case, the fact that you've got strictly indoor cats, they're probably very low risk. This would be something I would address with your veterinarian. But anytime we have a cat that's an indoor-outdoor cat, even in Wisconsin, they should be on some type of not only external parasite control for fleas and ticks, or at least fleas, but also on heartworm preventative, because there is no treatment for cats with heartworm disease. Unlike dogs that can go through treatment, for cats, there's nothing we can do. And so you're just kind of riding it out, hoping that they survive until the worms die of a natural death. And they can live for about 5 to 7 years inside the heart and blood vessels and so on.
Mm.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Bob in Madison, thanks to you for calling. Hello.
Yes, thank you for the program. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
I have a 12-year-old Dalmatian Golden Retriever mix, and I'm curious about his leg strength. And sometimes his leg kind of like twitches, vibrates. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Is there something, some supplements that we can get for him other than glucosamine conjointant, or is there acupuncture, chiropractic care that might take care of this nervous?
Potentially all the above. And why their legs shake like that, there's a number of reasons. It could be nerves. If they're frightened by something, they may just have part of their body tremor, and it can be the back end in some cases. But the fact that your dog is a 12-year-old large breed type dog, I worry more about either weakness and the dog standing up and just kind of overusing their muscle strength. Kind of like if I go to the gym and try to do too much lifting, I get to a point where my arms are shaking. That's the same kind of thing that's happening. It may be that your dog also has some arthritic change and has some pain in those back legs too. Besides, you know, the joint supplements that you mentioned, like glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate, which are readily available through your veterinarian over the counter, I always recommend consult with your vet, because they're going to know which ones you're actually getting active ingredient in. There are some glucosamine chondroitin supplements out there that are pretty useless just because there isn't a lot of regulation regarding their manufacture and sale. But, you know, you mentioned physical therapy, acupuncture, chiropractic. Yes, all of those things may be helpful if there is a pain component. You may want to consider talking to your veterinarian about trying your dog on something for treating arthritis that's more of a direct anti-inflammatory. And there are some safe medications that can be used in dogs that have a healthy liver function and kidneys. But that would be something, again, you'd probably, being an older dog, want to have at least a urine sample checked, a little bit of blood work done before you start trying your dog on a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory.
Sure. Okay. Thanks for your help.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I got a Facebook question from Sandy. He says, I have a 16-year-old female cat. Within the last couple of weeks is screaming at various times throughout the day, but more at night. Tested her for diabetes. It was negative. Didn't feel like I got good advice from the local vet of what to do next. He said maybe test her for thyroid, but he didn't perform that service. She can see well, has no major hearing loss. Any ideas what might be wrong?
Well, two things. I would be definitely checking for a thyroid problem. Many cats that are this age have an active thyroid nodule that secretes that hormone that kind of drives their metabolism, and so they can be a little more active, more vocal. And I think we need to get that off of the table. And it's a simple little blood test that would be helpful to get that done. But the other thing that I worry about is the fact that your cat is an older cat, and we do know that sometimes they have cognitive decline, kind of like senility. And I pulled out an article here that I just happened to have, and I'm trying to find, as they said, a recent study suggests that as 28% of pet cats aged 11 to 14 have geriatric onset behavior problems that include this type of problem. And it increases to over 50% of cats that are 15 years and up. So that could also be an issue for your kitty. And when we see cats with cognitive decline, and there's a few things that we can do. There are some supplemental medications and things that you can use. There is a diet that Hills has out that's called JD diet for cats that's very high in antioxidants, and as a diet has been found to be helpful for cats with senility as well. So that might be something to consider talking to your veterinarian about if your cat doesn't have any other underlying health problems that would prohibit them from being on this particular diet. But those would be my two guesses.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Facebook question from Judy, who wonders, says, I have a cat who occasionally licks my 6-pound Japanese chin's face. Can I use Canine Advantix if I keep them apart for a time after the application? If so, how long?
Well, Canine Advantix is a product that contains a flea preventative called imidacloprid, which is safe because we use it on cats as well. But it also contains a tick control agent called permethrin. And although the company says that you can use it if you keep them apart until it's dry, like overnight, I'm still very careful about using it on pets where you've got a close relationship between the dog and the cat, because permethrins can be quite toxic for cats. And I think that there are other safer things that we could use, such as any of the fipronil-based products, and that would include things like Frontline, Peristar, Fipriguard, Vet Shield, I think, is one of them, or Pet Shield is another one. So there's a number of those out on the market now. There's also a new collar that the Bear Company made. I brought this up last month. It's called the Seresto Collar, and it's identical chemical-wise for both dogs and cats. So if you have a dog with that collar on, it would be very safe for them to be in a household with a cat as well, since the cat tolerates the chemical. And it's a collar that controls fleas and ticks for 8 months. So might be something else to be looking into rather than using Advantix.
Denise in Lamira, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hello. I had to take you off speakerphone. Are you there?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yes, we are.
Sorry. We have a shelter dog. We've had him since November. And do dogs, is it true that they do get like a depression? Because sometimes he goes and finds the furthest corner of the house and he just lays there. And nothing we see or do, any kindness, will bring him out. Should we be worried about that?
Well, he may just be isolating himself because he wants a nap, and your household may be, you know, busy and active, and he's just found a spot that he can go into. And, you know, being a shelter dog, you know, maybe he's a little afraid of things and has found that he can find a nice little safe spot to be able to go into. We do see sometimes dogs going into a funk or a depression. Sometimes it's after losing a housemate, having a big change in routine. They may, you know, go off food and be, you know, not interacting like they normally would, maybe socially isolating themselves. But you always, you know, when you have a pet that starts displaying those behaviors, you want to rule out, is there a medical basis for it? So, you know, if your dog is just doing this once in a while, I'd say, you know, he probably just wants a break from people, especially if he's right back into the swing of things later on. But if this is becoming more common, it's associated with anything like a decreased appetite, weight loss, you know, anything that's even subtle changes that way, what you would want to do is get him in and have a good physical exam done. And make sure that there's nothing going on that may be able to be fixed.
All right, great. And one more quick question. What is your favorite flea and tick product?
I don't have one, okay? And I think it's because just as we were talking about with the last Facebook question, you really need to look at the lifestyle of the pet, whether they're swimming a lot, the amount of exposure that they have, whether there are other things that we need to keep under control, like intestinal parasites, what the outside mosquito burden is, you know, and there's all kinds of things. And so, you know, I tend to kind of glob on to, oh, this is new, maybe it's better. And you know, sometimes that works out. And other times, after using it for a year, we find out that, you know, this really wasn't any different than what we've been using in the past. If I had to say which one I tend to gravitate to for the majority of patients for flea and tick control, and ticks are out in full force right now, by the way, I would probably use one of the fipronil-based products. And again, Frontline, Fipriguard, Peristar, there's a whole host of them out there. Many of them are available just over the counter. Make sure that you know the accurate weight of your dog, and that's where getting it from your veterinarian, you would at least know what your dog weighs, so you're getting the correct dose. I had somebody order some medication online that was a flea and tick product, and they ordered it for their small dog, and what they ended up getting from this kind of bogus online online pharmacy is a large tube with a syringe with instructions as to how much to suck out of the tube to apply to their pet, which, you know, is not the best way of medicating. So that's why I'm a true believer in, you know, your vet knows best as to your pet's health as to, and what they would tolerate and kind of the household makeup of your home and whether you have kids and so on. Those are all things that need to be considered.
There
all
you
right,
go.
Great.
Thanks, Denise, for calling. Lynette in Richfield, hello.
Hi. Question about toenail clipping on dogs. Is it true that if you do it more frequently that the quick will grow longer, therefore it's not recommended to clip frequently?
Absolutely the opposite. The more often you do it and keeping it short, the quick is going to recede. I don't know if you've ever seen a human who is a chronic nail biter, where they're constantly chewing their nails off. Eventually, their nail actually becomes smaller. They have more of a fingertip rather than a nail covering it. And that's because they're constantly, you know, chewing it back. And so our quick, the attachment of the nail to our end of our finger, ends up receding. Same thing happens with dogs. So trimming them more often, grinding them down more often, you're going to find that the quicks will start to recede and you're actually going to have shorter nails.
Oh, that's good to know. Another thing, I received an email and I forwarded on to Judith regarding vaccinations. Today is a very discounted vaccination day at the Milwaukee Humane Society.
Okay.
I think it starts at 2:00 and I don't know how late it runs, but they're offering vaccinations for, I believe, rabies and distemper for an extremely discounted rate.
Good, good. You know, and just so that, you know, when people are vaccinating their pets, vaccine is a medical procedure. Rabies vaccine has to be done by a veterinarian or under the direct supervision of a veterinarian by a licensed technician. It needs to be administered in the correct spots on the body. And so, you know, sometimes you get what you pay for when you go to these clinics. You may not be getting the all-important physical exam to make sure that your pet is healthy enough to be able to be vaccinated, to be able to mount an immune response. I'm all for supporting the Humane Society, and I think saving money any way we can with pet care is a great idea. But if it's going to compromise the health of the pet, I just can't recommend it. So I'm not a huge fan of vaccination clinics, per se, unless the pet is getting a thorough physical exam at the same time.
There you go. All right. Thanks a lot, Lynette, for calling. Heather in Osceola, your turn. Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a found hound. He's probably about 5-6 years old now. He's a little shih tzu. He has got skin allergies, and it is already so bad that his little belly area is that orangish, dark reddish color that looks like old blood. I've been bathing him with baby shampoo. I had him on a single grain diet, and now I've got him on a grain-free diet. I don't know what else to do for him.
Well, the first thing you're going to do is call your veterinarian. I'm sounding like a broken record on this show. I'm sorry. Well, but first of all, a couple things you've mentioned. You've used a baby shampoo. The majority of dogs that have allergies have secondary yeast and bacterial infections. You would be better off bathing at least weekly to twice a week with a medicated shampoo that's going to have an antibacterial and antifungal component. So usually you're looking at a chlorhexidine and ketoconazole-based shampoo would be what I would be recommending. And that may help with keeping infections down to a dull roar. But any secondary infections need to be treated as well, and often those require medications that are going to be given orally in the form of tablets, antibiotics, antifungals, to be able to keep your pet comfortable. Washing bedding is also important, especially if your dog has any allergies to things like house dust mites. That is, you know, making sure that bedding is either replaced on an annual basis or preferably washed weekly. So be on the lookout for dog bedding that you can throw in the washer easily. But your comment about grains is one of those things that's kind of been a thorn in my side when it comes to feeding dogs. Grains have, for some reason, gotten the bad rap in the last few years for causing allergies in dogs. And when you start looking at what actually causes the allergies, if it is a food allergy, it is usually the protein source in the food, not the grain. Grains are not bad. And any dry food you feed is going to have a carbohydrate in it anyways. And so when you start comparing things like, you know, corn to, you know, to rice, to whatever, some of the products that people are saying, oh, I can't use a diet with corn or I can't use a diet with wheat in it, you're actually having a grain in there that's going to be a better benefit health-wise for the dog when it comes to nutrition than some of the other ones that are there to act as a carbohydrate source to kind of hold it together. So, if you truly want to rule out whether your dog has a food allergy, what you need to do is do an elimination diet trial, which means not going to the grocery store and just picking up random bags of food, but actually picking up a food from your veterinarian that's usually a hydrolyzed protein diet. Most of these diets are made from chicken, but they're broken down into little bits that are not recognized by the dog's body as to what the animal source is. The reason we can't use a lot of the over-the-counter diets is just like people that have allergies to peanuts, you know, they'll say right on products, this product has been made in a factory where peanuts have been processed. And so they're putting that warning out there because sometimes just a little bit of dust of something that the pet is allergic to or the human is allergic to can be enough to trigger a significant allergic response. The commercial-made dog foods, they will not, you know, sterilize, clean everything, you know, in and out before they make another batch of food. There's often residue from some of the other food that's in there versus these hydrolyzed protein diets, which have to be made in very specific factories that are not going to allow the other allergens to be able to get in there. So I think that if you really want to rule food allergies out, that would be your way to go rather than just, you know, willy-nilly picking diets and going with this trend of grain-free diets, which is all that is just
a trend.
A trend, and it has nothing to do with pets' health.
There. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Heather. Rick, your turn. Hi.
Hello?
Yes, hi, Rick.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just listened to the last caller, and I have something similar with my yellow lab, but it's seasonal. It seems like every year about this time, she starts chewing on her feet, and her little belly kind of turns dark, mm-hmm. and she just itches.
Yeah.
And it really... I'll use different shampoos and things, but it really doesn't seem to take care of that problem. So.
Yeah, well, this is an area where, you know, I use the quote that about one in five dogs experiences allergies. And so here we've had two phone calls, okay?
Yeah.
Back to back with pets with allergies. What your dog is experiencing seasonally makes me think that it's probably something out in the environment, some molds, pollen, something that is, you know, coming out now after the snow melts that is in the backyard that your dog is either inhaling or having coming into contact with. The most common spots on a dog's body that become itchy when they have allergies are either their ears or their feet, but it can be generalized to all over the body as well. So things that you would want to do, just like the last caller, making sure that you maybe wash the dog's bedding, HEPA filter to keep down some of that pollen and mold and stuff that may be, you know, in your home, keeping the humidity down in your home, which is going to help keep things drier. So house dust mites and things may not be as prevalent. Bathing your dog a couple of times a week to help get rid of some of those allergens. You can talk to your veterinarian about other therapies, and things that people will usually try on their own would be things like over-the-counter antihistamines, which don't work that well, may take the edge off the dog. But what your veterinarian could provide you with would be other safer alternatives, whether it be a topical steroid spray that you can apply to your dog's feet, medication to treat the secondary infections that may be there. And believe me, when a dog starts licking at their feet, almost every time I spread those toes, collect some of that toe jam and look under the microscope, I find yeast and bacteria that need to be treated. Right. You're not going to see that by just looking at the feet. It needs to be something that is evaluated microscopically. And so your dog may need to have those infections treated, as well as, you know, maybe even looking at long-term use of something that will suppress the immune system, like cyclosporin. There's a drug called Atopica for dogs that is very safe for the majority of dogs that go on it, unlike oral steroids, which can have lots of side effects. So I tend to avoid using any steroids that are given orally. Topical is okay, but you don't want to go orally.
I have one other issue, is that I me regularly to the dog park. I go out to Prairie Moraine outside of Verona. It's beautiful. I get a nice walk in, and so does the dog. She thinks it's a veritable buffet out there. She's just running around eating stuff, pulling stuff off the ground, and there's nothing that I can really do to stop her. But I'm concerned about what she's eating and what I might be wary of, or what precautions I might take.
Well, short of using a leash or putting a basket muzzle on your dog, which is probably going to make the trip to the dog park not very pleasant for either of you, because your dog will look like Hannibal Lecter, and you know, they're not going to get the same exercise as, you know, being on leash rather than off. Making sure that your dog is on a regular deworming program, which is typical if they are on monthly heartworm preventative. And I would be using it year-round, which is what the national guidelines are. In this area, we use heartworm preventatives year-round, not so much for heartworm control because we don't have mosquitoes in the middle of winter, but for intestinal parasite control. So that would be one of the things to do. I'd be recommending probably twice a year fecal evaluations, where you take a stool sample in and your veterinarian will look for parasites. And keeping your dog up to date on their vaccinations, so that in case they're ingesting material from another dog that may be infected with parvovirus or distemper or something, your dog isn't going to get ill from that. Mm. So I think that's about all you can do.
And thanks a bunch for calling, Rick. Appreciate it. We have a Facebook question from Buzz. Sandy says, I have a 10-year-old male cat who's discovered after a recent urine analysis to have red blood cells in his urine. My vet does not have any medical explanation for this. We switched his food to Royal Canin.
Mm-hmm,
what
mm-hmm.
could be the cause for this? Is he in pain?
Well, red blood cells are one of those things that, depending on how the urine sample was collected, it may be real, it may not be. The way we like to collect urine from a cat is doing a procedure called a cystocentesis, which is putting a very fine needle into the bladder so that we can collect a sterile urine sample. It's, you know, unlike with humans where they can send you down the hall with a cup and say, you know, go in this. It's hard for us to be able to do that with a cat. Sometimes we will send home some of the non-absorbent cat litter that you can put in the cat's litter box so that you can collect the sample at home. If your cat is asymptomatic, meaning is not straining, is not acting uncomfortable, having accidents outside the box, if this was just a random, hey, there's a few red blood cells in the urine, if they were found on a dipstick, which is a little chemical analysis of the urine, I would be following up with a urine sediment so that you can see, are there a lot of crystals there? Are there white blood cells there? Is there an infection or something going on? But if it's, you know, everything's normal, just a few red blood cells, nothing much there, I'd say just recheck it again, because it may have been the method that was used to collect the urine. So it's hard to, without me having more history, hard for me to give any more information than that.
Facebook question from Lindsay, who has a 13-year-old cat who's very finicky when it comes to her food. I've tried dry food, wet food, high quality, even lower quality. She'll meow and meow, don't tell me she's hungry, but no matter what I try to feed her, she sniffs her nose at it and turns away. Any suggestions? Will inside cats literally starve themselves? Or is she nibbling when I'm not watching?
Well, I would expect that if she is alive and thriving, meaning not losing weight, she's finding stools in the litter box, that the cat is eating something.
She loves cheese.
Yeah, well, cheese is not the best food to give to a cat. I mean, it's high in fat. It's not going to be well balanced. But there is an appetite, kind of a stimulant powder that has a cheese, like a Parmesan cheese, dried cheese base that you can sprinkle on food. I'm going to be divulging a kind of a secret, but I used to work with the Fancy Feast cats, and I've traveled around the country with them many years ago. And one of the things, one of the Fancy Feast cats didn't like Fancy Feast unless we sprinkled this cheese powder on top. And, you know, and so it was one that ended up having to be retired very early because we didn't want to make the public realize that, you know, hey, he doesn't like the food we're trying to market here. So that would be something that you could try to see. But it, yeah, I, again, if the cat's doing fine, but if they're not, if they're losing weight, there may be a medical reason for it. Dental disease, some other underlying health problem that's making the cat feel nauseated, like kidney disease or liver disease. So getting them checked out would be a good idea.
Marsha, a Facebook question for Marsha. I understand that garlic is deadly to dogs until I heard another animal person indicate it was good for them. Would you please clarify the garlic question for me and other pet owners?
Well, garlic, especially for cats, is a problem because it can cause what's called Heinz body anemia. I tend to avoid garlic if possible in dogs because it can be a problem for them as well, although they tend to tolerate it a little bit better than cats do. But it's one of those things where they don't need it. I, you know, would avoid, you know, using it if you're making your own homemade treats or whatever. Putting a lot of garlic in it, I think it's not a necessary thing. We tend to like to avoid onions and garlic. They're all in the same family because they can cause some toxicity issues.
On to Audrey in Appleton. Audrey, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for listening to me.
Sure.
I have a problem with my 9-year-old cat. All of a sudden, she started urinating and pooing all over my house. And I've taken her to the vet, and they checked out to make sure that she didn't have a bladder problem or a kidney problem, which she does not have. I have bought new litter boxes because I have two other cats. So the vet suggested that I needed one more litter box, so I now have three.
Four would be better.
Yes. Yeah. Larry, thank you for saying that. We usually like to have a litter box for every cat plus one would be the ideal number.
Right. I changed the litter out, so I do that anyway. Occasionally, you know, maybe once a month I take all the litter out, wash the boxes, put new litter in. I take the feces and stuff out of the boxes on a daily basis, so they don't have dirty boxes. I've tried everything. I bought one of these things that you plug in the wall from the vet that gives off phenoms, I think he said.
Pheromones, yeah.
Pheromones, uh-huh. So that it's supposed to relax her. She's had that plugged in the wall for a couple of weeks. That's not working. I put things over the spots where she's gone to the bathroom so she can't go there anymore. And what she does is I've seen her do it. She backs her butt up against the spot that she's going to go to the bathroom, shakes her tail, and sprays.
Mm-hmm.
She's been spayed.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. We've got lots of good information here. I'm going to just kind of go through, first of all, how I would address this case. Number one, yes, you did a great job taking your cat to your veterinarian. And again, your veterinarian may have checked for this, but a kitty that's 9 years old should also be evaluated for a thyroid condition. I have many cats that become hyperthyroid that are so physiologically stressed that they start not using the litter box and urine marking. And so if that was not part of the workup, it should be. And you may need to take your kitty back in to have that checked. It's a blood test. And so it's, you know, it takes a day or two to get back. We usually send them out to an outside lab and we get the report back. And if that's what it is, you may have your problem solved. We already mentioned that you don't have enough litter boxes. You need four. And you didn't mention what kind of litter boxes you have, but that can sometimes be one of the issues as well, especially in a multi-cat household. If you have cats that maybe don't get along well, there's a little bit of social grief, having covered litter boxes can sometimes make a cat feel like they're, you know, locked inside a sitting duck and the bully cat may torment them when they're in the covered box. So we always like to try to have open pans about 1.5 times the length of the cat from head to toe, or from head to butt. Okay, so kind of measure your cat. So it needs to be big enough that they can move around in it. And so things that I like to use rather than the standard litter boxes would be like storage bins that you can get, like the ones that you can go under the bed that are kind of a low level, you know, storage bin, cement mixing trays, very inexpensive at a home repair place. They're like $350 or so, and so you can buy lots of those as well. Looking at the location where you put your litter boxes, a lot of people like to group the litter boxes together and maybe put them in a not as easily accessible place like the basement. That also is a spot that could be a little scary because it may have a furnace and water softeners that are discharging and so on. So having them scattered throughout the house would be a good idea. The litter you use, many cats like the soft, scoopable, sandy litter. Scent doesn't appear to be a huge problem. We always try to go with the lowest scent possible. What you're describing your cat doing, though, is marking. When cats are quivering their tail, backing up to a vertical object and squirting out a stream of urine, that is considered marking behavior. And cats mark when they're anxious, and whether that's because they have something like a thyroid problem or whether it's because there's stray cats outside or some grief between the other two cats in the household that you may not be recognizing, because cats can be very passively aggressive. That would be kind of what I would be looking into, is what is causing this cat to be so stressed. The Feel Away pheromone diffuser may help a little bit. It's not a standalone product. Sometimes we have to look at medical management for these cats as well. But it's, you know, I think going back to the drawing board and saying, let's check that thyroid level, and then we'll start addressing how can we change the environment to make these cats get along a little bit better. You know, and it's a tough one. But female cats, even if they're spayed, can spray. About one in 10 male cats will spray, and about 1 in 20 female cats will spray at least sometime during their life.
There you go, Audrey. Thank you very much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can join us for live coverage of the annual State of the Tribes Address today at 1 o'clock, streaming online at WPR.org. Lacouture Chairman Gordon Thayer presents the address before a joint session of the Wisconsin Legislature. It's live from the state capitol. That's the State of the Tribes Address today at 1 o'clock, streaming at WPR.org. Talking about your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk right now, we had an email from Janet in Oak Creek who said her cat, Carmine, has chapped and cracked paws, all four of them, changed his food to a science diet, canned and dry, used a Neosporin and bag balm on his paws. They're better, but still scaly and dry. Can cats get athlete's foot? I'll take them back to the vet, but what's your opinion?
Yeah, well, cats, athlete's foot is a fungus, and it's unlikely that your cat has anything, the same fungus that affects us, although they do get other fungal skin infections like ringworm that could potentially be a problem. But I wouldn't expect it to be on the pads. When I see all 4 feet being like dry and cracked and chapped, the thing that jumps to mind is some type of an immune problem, one of the pemphigus type problems that we'll see in cats. And this is something that if your veterinarian is concerned, you may be looking at either a biopsy, which is not going to be very comfortable, or an evaluation by a veterinary dermatologist to be able to assess what's going on with those feet. You know, I don't know if they're painful or not, but if they are, then definitely get that looked into, because sometimes, you know, we'll see what looks like a fairly minor problem, but it can turn into something pretty major.
Steven Sun Prairie, hello.
Good morning. Here we are. It's right about lunchtime, so I have a question about cat vomit.
All right.
I have two cats that get wet food in the morning, and the other day one of them ate his food in a hurry, as he always does, and then a few minutes later headed over to the other cat's dish, and I noticed that gee, that cat hadn't eaten very much at all. And I looked, and it's because cat number one had vomited his food into the other cat's dish.
Oh, gross. Oh, okay. No.
Who was promptly eating it.
Yes. Ah. Okay. Yeah.
And my question was, I think that the cat that vomited, it just vomited because he ate too fast. But my question is there any harm in the one cat eating the other cat's vomit?
No, not really, because when we have a cat that has this kind of piggy cat syndrome, it's just the food's going down and back up again, and it hasn't been processed. There's not going to be a lot of gastric acid or anything in it. It's disgusting, but that's welcome to the world of animals. One of the things that I'll tell people to do to kind of slow the cat down, and I have to do this with my own cats, is when they get their canned food in the morning, I stand there, I'm making my tea and things, and I'll give them like a teaspoon, let them eat it, and then add a little bit more. Alternatively, you can kind of, if you're depending on the style of food you're using, you can take it and kind of ice a plate rather than putting it in a saucer for the cat to eat. So you're spreading it out over in a real thin layer that the cat has to kind of walk around and lick up small bits, and it just slows them down a little bit more. So considering trying something like that, I've even used things like a muffin tin where you just put a little dab of cat food in each of the little containers of a muffin tin, and that slows the cat down too. So, no, I wouldn't worry about your cats. And I know these cats, and so I have to send a shout out to them. So this is, George, okay, is one. And the other one is Gus. And they're both wonderful cats because I recognize Steve's voice. He's one of the clients at the vet school. So,
wonderful. Yep. Thanks, Steve.
Okay, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Yeah. Well, we have Kay in New Auburn with a question for you. Sandy?
Hello. Hi. Yeah, our dog this morning had a little bit of minor surgery, and he's got a few stitches, you know, two or three, and I'm afraid he's going to have to wear one of these cones.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Does he have to wear this all the time, or can he have a break from it? And will it bother him as much as it bothers us?
Yeah, you know, this is a something that we as veterinarians, we call them, you know, we joke about them, the cone of shame and different things. But it's really important to keep it on if the dog is going to be able to get at the incision and lick at it, because it's an old wives' tale that dogs licking their wounds will make them heal faster. They actually will get infected. They'll be moist. They'll maybe even pull their stitches out. And depending on what kind of surgery was done, it could be a life-threatening consequence. I've seen like abdominal incisions open up with a dog chewing its sutures, and you know the dog losing its life because they lost everything from their abdominal cavity out onto the floor. So I keep it on as long as it's needed by your veterinarian. You're following your veterinarian's instructions. But if you are there and watching your dog, and maybe you've got them on a leash and they're not exercise restricted for whatever the surgery was done for, that's the time that they can have it off. So maybe out in public, your dog doesn't have to be so embarrassed. They can have the cone off. But especially when you're not there physically or mentally, such as when you're sleeping, keep that cone on.
There you go. Thanks, Kay, for calling. Margie in Superior, hello. Are you there, Margie?
Yes, I am. I really love this show, and I love my 2-year-old Maltese. The problem that I have is she has the drippy eyes that come with dogs with large eyes. And so when I took her to the veterinarian, he didn't seem to have a real solution to stop the dripping. And so one of my friends that has a small poodle said, well, use angel eyes. And it's a powdered... I think it's chicken liver. Yeah, it's 100% freeze-dried chicken liver. But everything I've tried to mix in with her, it in with her food has, she smells it and won't eat it.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, can I just feed her very small quantities of chicken liver that I cook, or is there another solution that I just don't know about?
Well, I've never heard of chicken liver being a cure for a piphora, which is runny eyes. Mm-hmm. I would first of all make sure that your dog doesn't have anything like extra eyelashes, hair that is touching the eyeball. So keeping your dog's face groomed to keep it from wicking.
Yeah, I trim it regularly.
And then if your dog is ever sedated or under anesthesia, making sure that they have normal tear ducts, that they don't have a problem with, a tear duct being blocked or just not developed appropriately. But it comes down to that staining on the face is usually cosmetic. The things that we have found to be somewhat helpful would be some of those kind of agents that you can buy at grooming parlors, Diamond Eye, Eye Envy, which are solutions that you put on the face that will help bleach and keep that hair the hair from looking that brown color. There has been some reports that using a probiotic by the name of Prostora, the Iams company makes it, and you may be able to get it from your veterinarian, has had some benefit for these dogs. Why? I have no idea, but it may be changing the bacteria flora or something there. I really don't know why it works, but I've had people say, yeah, my dog went on it and their face got better. And it would be something that would be safe that your dog could be on all the time and are in a little tasty, chewable tablet. So it might be something to consider using. But chicken liver, I don't think so.
Yeah, I have no idea why that would work.
I have no idea either.
It says it's 100% on the ingredients label, it's 100% freeze-dried chicken liver.
Well, show me the proof. I want to see the documented research that chicken liver being fed to the dog is going to stop tear staining. So it's probably just one of those things where somebody did it, their dog got better, and so now they're marketing it. And so you got to be careful when you read those claims.
Thanks again for calling, Margie. Appreciate it very much. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, will be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, then we'll be back with Dr. Standy. Stay with us. If animals are an important part of your family, I bet you want to keep them healthy and happy. But with new information coming out all the time, lots of different opinions, it's hard to know what to do as a responsible pet owner. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. We're glad to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine as our guest today. And she'll be with us for the next half hour to share what she knows, a lot of what she knows, and give you some timely advice. And, you know, maybe you're a lifelong dog owner, or maybe you're brand new with your dog or your kitty. Doesn't matter. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. You can visit our Facebook page for updates, news, and photos as well. For that, just go to The Larry Mueller Show. We've got lots of photos up there right now, as a matter of fact. Click like while you're there. We'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. Back after the news. Often pretty stressful when we become ill, and I think it can be just as stressful when one of our pets is ill. And with so much information out there, sometimes it's hard to know what's right, because a lot of times one piece of information will contradict another one. Well, once a month, we have a chance to talk to Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have you back, Sandy.
And I love doing this show, too, because it keeps me on my toes. I'm always having to peruse literature and what's out there in the news. So thank you for all your great calls.
We had a Facebook question from Marilyn that relates to a show last month's show, you mentioned a flea and tick collar that lasted for 8 months, and she wanted you to spell the name.
Okay, it is the Seresto collar, and it's spelled Seresto. It's by the Bayer Animal Health Company. And it consists, it's a collar that is the same ingredients for both cats and dogs, so it's a safe collar that way. And it has imidacloprid, which is the active ingredient in Advantage for controlling fleas, as well as a synthetic permethrin that is safe for use in cats called a flumethrin, I think is what it's called. Probably a bear rep is listening to me going, no, but I'm sorry, but it's that is one of the reasons why, you know, we're always concerned about, can we use something that's compatible with both dogs and cats.
And that's Seresto?
Right.
Seresto.
Seresto or
Seresto.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have Bev in Rushford up next. Hi, Beverly. Thank you for calling.
thank you for hearing this. I have a German Shepherd who is about 5 years old now, and she was tested for Lyme's last year, and she tested very strongly for anaplasmosis. And I went on the antibiotic regime for as long as was expected, and she never had any symptoms of Lyme's at all. But now I want to know if you can tell me, give me the whole scoop on what Lyme's does, why you have to have it, a revaccination every year, and it's not called a booster, it's called a vaccination, and she would have to have them for the rest of her life.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. What you are experiencing is what we are seeing in the state, that both anaplasma and the Lyme organism are spread by the deer tick. And so, you know, deer ticks love this cooler weather. So they like to come out when it's in the mid-30s, 40-degree range, and many people have not put their dog on flea and tick preventative, and then they don't even know that their dogs have been bit, because these ticks can be quite small and transmit these diseases. If you want to look at what the incidence is in your particular county, there's a wonderful website by the Companion Animal Parasite Council, and it's CAPC, C-A-P-C, vet, vet.org. And they have a thing that says incident map, and you'll get a map of the United States. Just click on Wisconsin, you click on which county you're in, and they'll tell you heartworm, anaplasma, ehrlichiosis, Lyme disease, and so on. And you can see what the incidence is in your area. And it is really high for in certain parts of the state for all these diseases. Many dogs that get exposed never become clinical. And so when we're doing the screening, the main reason is to educate owners that their dogs are being bit and they potentially could become clinical. I don't treat everybody that tests positive. Sometimes it's based on what the owner would like to do. But with doxycycline, the drug that we typically use, going to become a scarcer supplied drug. It's going to be coming quite pricey in the next couple of months because of manufacturing or whatever. We're going to be actually handing it out probably a little more judiciously at the veterinary school in the future. But why do we vaccinate dogs with the Lyme vaccine? It's because it will help decrease the incidence of your dog developing or, you know, getting clinical signs of this disease. And if you are living in a heavy Lyme area, by all means, get your dog vaccinated. It's a series of two vaccinations to start with, and then we need to do a booster vaccination every year after that. So we go once a year, and it's because it's not a viral vaccine like many of the vaccines we use, which provide longer term immunity, like rabies vaccine we do every 3 years. Because of the nature of the bug, you have to vaccinate annually. Sorry about that.
And thanks for calling, Beverly. Appreciate it. Elizabeth emailed, my 4-year-old Papillon had his teeth cleaned for the first time last year. Vet said his teeth were good. Little plaque. Do you recommend annual teeth cleaning for all dogs?
Boy, you know, I know just a few weeks ago, our dental folks from the vet school came in here and they would be saying, by all means, getting a good comprehensive oral exam done, just like we do when they recommend us going in every 6 months. You know, I'm always surprised when I go to the dentist, they find bits of plaque and stuff that are tartar on my teeth, and I brush and floss daily. And so, you know, if you're doing a dog, are you brushing effectively? Are they, you know, are you doing it all the time? If you've got really good at-home care, you may be able to stretch it a little bit. But for the majority of dogs, we're looking at annual dental hygiene would be what's recommended.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. We've got some emails. We've got some Facebook questions. We've got an email from a retired veterinarian, Wayne Hoppe, who's treated feline cognitive function disorder. He has used, if you get excessive vocalization at night, He uses a
selegiline. Okay.
Selegiline?
Yeah, and that's a drug called Anapril. It's labeled for dog use. It's not labeled for cat use. And we do sometimes use that medication in cats. And it is a prescription medication. And it has its own kind of range of side effects. But first of all, you need to rule out for animals that have problems with vocalizing at night, other medical things that need to be treated appropriately before we start jumping into using something like that. But I appreciate him letting us know about that because, you know, I have used it in the past in cats and I will continue to use it. But it's just one of many things that we have up our sleeve for dealing with cognitive decline.
Bob in Wauwatosa, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Our trim 12-year-old English Field Spaniel is getting medication for hepatitis following a liver biopsy and tissue cultures. And we were advised to replace his morning and evening kibble, which was a 50-50 mix of two high-quality foods, with a special low-copper kibble.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand the need for the problem with copper was explained to me. He had excess copper in his liver, according to the biopsy
mm-hmm.
results. So
mm-hmm.
I understand the need for the low copper kibble, but his previous 50-50 kibble mix averaged 23.5% protein. The new food is just 14%.
Right, right.
The old mix was 11.5% fat, and the new kibble is 14% fat.
Yeah,
what's the rationale here? This doesn't sound like healthier food.
I love the fact that you're reading pet food labels. I wish all of my clients would do that because, you know, so often they just have no idea what they're buying, but what you're feeding, when we have a dog with copper storage disease, which can result in liver failure, it's really important that you feed a liver-appropriate diet, which usually, like as you said, has a lower copper content in it. But the other thing, the liver is an important organ for a lot of things, but one of the things that it does is it handles a protein digestion and protein waste products. And so if you have a diet that is has more protein than the dog needs to be able to survive, they're going to have more nitrogenous wastes in their body, primarily ammonia, which can affect the brain and have them actually develop an issue where they call it hepatoencephalopathy, where they can start seizuring and having mentation changes and so on. So the lower protein diet, you can't just look at the percentage of protein. You have to look at how digestible that protein is and the quality of the protein. So even though it's lower, which it should be for a dog with liver disease, and it should be more biologically available, and so your dog may be getting a higher quality protein and a little bit less of it to be able to keep that liver healthier. So the fat is because many dogs with some type of organ problem, such as kidney disease or liver disease, often don't eat as much and need some extra calories to be able to help maintain their body weight. And so these foods can sometimes have extra fat, not only to increase the palatability, but also to increase the calorie content as well. So they're all there for a reason, and I think it's great that you're looking at it and following your veterinarian's directions.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Thank you very much for calling. And let's turn to Kay in Prairie du Sac next. Hi, Kay.
Hi. First off, I want to thank Dr. Sawchuk for mentioning the vet school tour on Sunday. I went, and it was fantastic.
Thank you so much. We had about 3,000 people attend.
And I mean, what you went through to put up together all the displays and the footprints on the floor so we could do the self-tours, and the students were so helpful and welcoming. I just hope you do that every other year.
We are going to be, and so the next one is planned for 2015. So, yeah.
Wonderful. No. Okay, my question relates to the laser therapy that's used for promoting healing for arthritis and for swelling and wound healing. Can you explain how that works?
Nope. It's a different frequency than a laser that would be used for like cutting tissues, which is like used for surgery. And so it's and it helps stimulate blood supply to the area. And I think I wish I knew, but this would be something for me to do some homework on. And but I know that we do have that capability at the veterinary school. And many vets are getting into this specialized laser therapy for dealing with injuries, soft tissue injuries, and so on. So I wish I could help you, but I can't.
Look it up. We'll talk about it next month.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks, Kate. Yeah, there's always another month. We'll do it next month.
I know. I hate saying I don't know, but I you have to sometimes.
Yeah, you do. Cindy and Exonia, hello.
Hi. Oh, I'm so glad I got through. Okay, I'll make it brief. We got a barn kitty. We rescued 28 cats from a barn.
Wow.
And we decided to keep one, and he's wonderful. He's all black. His name is Murphy. We took him in, and we got him all cleaned up, and but come to find out that he was developing crystals. He has been fixed. And so now we got him on the Royal Canin cat food. That's what the vet suggested.
Okay.
We had to lower something in the system too, so that we can avoid this problem.
Was he having symptoms of the crystals in the urine? Like, did he get obstructed, or was he straining?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. At one point, I was able to get a real clean urine sample, and I took that to the. And he said, "Yeah, he's got some developing crystals in there." But he said, "We're going to try this, changing the cat food." Yeah, he was going in the cat box like. We have four cat boxes. We're doing exactly what you're saying with the cat boxes. Mm-hmm. And but he was going constantly from one cat box to the other one, like almost every minute.
Oh, my goodness.
So something's wrong here. Something's wrong. So we took him in immediately. But I feel so sorry for him because he can only eat this stuff. And he wants to eat what our other cats are eating. We buy really good cat food.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. When we see crystals in the cat's urine when they're not symptomatic, it may be normal because when cats produce such concentrated urine that if you collect a urine sample from them and just let it come down to room temperature and you're looking at it, so that would be the case of collecting it at home and bringing it in, crystals will start coming out of solution. And so, sometimes we have to look at, are those crystals really a problem? But if he was having issues of straining and being uncomfortable, and especially if it was accompanied by an enlarged bladder where he may have had a partial obstruction and was just getting little dribbles of urine out, and yet it was continuing to make urine, that's a medical emergency, and those crystals are a real problem for him, and it can be a life-threatening problem. And so I'm sorry, but he's just going to have to buck up and eat that food. And what you're probably using is the Royal Canin, what's called SO diet. The S stands for struvite. The O stands for oxalate. Those are the two most common crystals that can cause medical problems and medical emergencies for cats. And this diet not only helps dissolve those crystals and sometimes the stone as well, if there happens to be visible stones in their urine or in their bladder, but it helps prevent them from recurring as well. And I think you've just got too much at risk if by introducing something else. Now, there are other diets that fit this bill, like the Hills has one that's called CD Multi, that is does same thing as SO diet. So there are other things that you can give him, but it just comes down to when we have cats, we have to feed cats as individuals. And even people that have a multi-cat household without a cat with a medical problem sometimes do their cats a disservice by providing the same food for all the cats, because some cats may need a higher calorie diet, some may need a lower calorie diet, some may need more fiber. And the only way you can do that is feeding cats as an individual, just like people with a multi-dog household usually do. Each dog gets their own bowl of food. And it's a wise move to have your cats being fed on a, separate basis.
Okay, we do that. Can I add a little dribble of juice from some of the other
Oh, sure. Oh, sure.
On top of his?
Oh, yeah. You can do that. But, you know, SO also comes in canned versions as well. So you can talk to your veterinarian to say, hey, if I can't get the SO, can I get a canned version of one of the other products that a different company makes that would be similar? And, you know, if your veterinarian doesn't carry all the different therapeutic diets, there are ways that you can get them through online pharmacies as well. And they can be shipped directly to your house. And so, you know, we don't carry everything at the vet school. And sometimes we have to, you know, script out a prescription for these foods for somebody else to be able to get delivered right to their home.
Yep, there you go. Thanks, Cindy.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Rory in Hales Corners. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I have a question. We are moving to Florida, and we have a St. Bernard, and everybody is yelling at me, you can't take the St. Bernard to Florida. And we're just wondering if she has, like, medium hair. It's not real long. If her hair was cut a little bit shorter or not.
Is she a house dog? She's in the house.
Oh, yeah. She's the most spoiled dog ever.
And I assume you're going to have air conditioning.
Of course.
All right. So, you know, dogs are pretty smart. They may go out, do their business, and come back in again. They may decide that I'm going to go out and run around the backyard when it's cooler in the morning than when it's hot and humid in the afternoon. The worry that I have about shaving the hair close is that it's going to predispose her to sunburn. So I would not do that.
No.
Okay. That's what we thought, that it almost protects them from the heat.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, okay, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for calling. Email from Eric. We have been living in Italy for 6 years. We're now returning to Madison with a dog that was rescued. What's the current thinking on medication for the plane flight? And besides rabies, what vaccinations are needed or recommended?
It is so easy to get in this country. All you need to have is a current rabies vaccination, unlike getting into other countries where you have to jump through a lot of hoops and sometimes quarantine and so on. Do not medicate the dog if they're going to be flying in the baggage area. That is the leading cause of death for dogs, is the medication that's been given, and then they can't be observed and they lose their body temperature. Body temperature drops, or they vomit, or something happens. So crate adapt your dog, get them comfortable with the crate before you go in the airplane so that it's not a big scary thing on the day that you travel.
And here's Denise in Madison with a question for you. Hi, Denise.
Hi. I was calling because my dog just had bloat recently, but 2 weeks ago he had surgery for it and is recovering nicely, and I'm just wondering what I can do to change his diet to help prevent it from happening again.
Yeah, there's a number of things you can do. Primarily, what we're looking at is going with multiple meals a day rather than one meal a day, not allowing them to gulp their food. Mm-hmm. And so looking at, you know, using one of those break fast bowls or something that is going to allow them to slow down. Some people will recommend getting an elevated food dish, but that's actually been found to be one of the risk factors for developing bloat. And so, that's just one thing to be thinking about. Be careful with water. If they've had a lot of exercise and they, you know, come back in and load up on water, they can actually bloat with excessive water intake as well. So be there to kind of dole out water in smaller amounts. But you're looking for diets that are kind of low fermentation diets. And so it may be, if you're looking at the last diet you were using, if it had a lot of soya in it or something that was, highly fermentable, avoiding that kind of diet and going with something else. And usually, I mean, your veterinarian may recommend using at least temporarily an intestinal diet from one of the prescription diet companies, and that might be something that your dog could stay on long term. That's going to be kind of a low residue, not very fermentable, and help keep that GI tract healthy.
Okay. So is a grain-free diet a good idea?
Not necessarily, because it's not the grain, because you're still going to have carbohydrates. And so it really is going to depend on, are potatoes better than rice, or is rice better than wheat? No, but I'd just be avoiding soya. That would be the thing that I would avoid.
All right.
Great, thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling. As long as you mention food, Maybe we can make a comment on food recalls, Sandy.
They are occurring all the time, and you know why? It's because we're watching for them. And the big thing is the salmonella recalls. Anything that has animal tissue in it could actually get salmonella. And, you know, the company that just had major, major recall is the company that makes Innova, California Natural, Evo. And I literally have about a 10-page document listing every one of their foods that has been recalled for salmonella. And it's not so much for the pet's health. We are doing it for the human health. A lot of pets can ingest it and not get sick from it. Some do, but we want to keep people healthy. So it just goes to show you got to handle pet food very carefully all the time. Treats, dog food, and so on. Use separate utensils and don't let kids play around the bowls.
And so that was Evo, you were saying?
Yeah, and I think it's the company is Natura, N-A-T-U-R-A, is the one they've recalled all of their, pretty much all of their diets, and that was just about a week ago.
Sandy, thank you so much.
You'll be welcome
back on my birthday. May 14th?
All right.
We'll look forward to that. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be back, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, back on my birthday on May 14th. Tomorrow, Smokey the Bear says we should prevent forest fires. We'll talk about what a forest needs to be healthy. Stay with us.